I can only add my testimony to this from personal experience. When I was on maneuvers with my regiment in the World War, we would go from Hell 1, just south of Cairo, into this enormous mountainous area near Sinai and near the Suez Canal. And we would stop over at night and get a chance to walk around. And all over the place, there were huge shoals of shells, as high as this room, as deep as this room, seashells, on the tops of hills and gullies, 2,000 feet above sea level. You can go and see them for yourself. They were never explained to me. No one ever told me, and I asked around. No one could explain, oh, well, way in the far. Well, the fact is that regions can be inundated quite easily if there is a period of activity on the Earth which is geophysical. So the Atlanteans sailed to the coast of Egypt, and they settled there. It suited them. It was warm. It was warm like their own home island. And they built a pyramid just about there, 70,000 years ago. There was no delta. There was no delta there at all. Today, the silt from the high mountains of Abyssinia and lakes in those mountains have produced a silt which has slowly, progressively, over 70,000 years, laid down a delta here. But the purpose of the pyramid there, when it was started, the purpose of the pyramid was that it was going to stand on the seashore in a place that could be seen by ships here and by ships there. However, various events occurred and the pyramid was not completed then, and so I'm against the proposition of Leadbeater that it was finished and done with 70,000 years ago. No, what happened was that the pyramid that was built and used was built as a truncated version of a pyramid, about a third of the height of the completed pyramid, about a third of the height of the completed pyramid. And this truncated version had within it a chamber called today the Queen's Chamber, and it was used through the centuries by the pharaohs who knew about it as a storeroom for gold, because very frequently, especially in the last 10,000 years, Egypt was overrun by hordes of warriors from Nubia, from Abyssinia, from Persia, Syria, and so on. And so it functioned like that. But at the same time, it was used as an observatory in the sense that the thing that strikes you when you live in the Western Desert for a period of time is the clearness of the skies at night, night after night after night. And it was inevitable that the Egyptians, whether they were Atlanteans or coming after the Atlanteans, would want to know when the Nile would come down. It was very important for them to know. So they had nilometers. They had nilometers built on the banks of the Nile, which measured the level of the waters. And they could know what the level of the water was way up the Nile down here. And precautions could be taken if the level was getting higher and higher. A message would come down here, you're going to have floods and so on and so on. So what they wanted to do here was to plot the stars of the heavens exactly as they were seen. Exactly as they were seen. And they chose a square, and quite often you get square horoscopes. They're not unusual. They're divided up in a different way. And all the constellations were plotted there. This was north. Sorry, well, forget that drawing. That's north. And there was this long passageway, which is at a certain angle, enabling an astronomer, and there were astronomers in those days, to see certain heavenly structures. For instance, the Pleiades. The Pleiades could be seen from the depths of this long passageway. And they could observe also when Virgo was rising on the horizon, and when that actually happened, or whatever, they would know that very soon the Nile waters would be arriving and that certain precautions had to be taken. And it is said by people like the Master Joao Cool that the most accurate astrology ever known was in ancient Egypt. And that Manichaeus said that it was because there was an accurate plotting of the heavens at that time. But like all civilizations, they fell away, and Egypt also fell away, and all these wonderful old sciences were buried, as it were. And then it was that the sands of the desert covered most of this truncated pyramid. And then it was that Cheops, very powerful man, powerful mainly because he lived a long time, Cheops discovered, or through his advisors, discovered that the wind had blown away sand and had revealed this old truncated form of the pyramid. And he decided that he would do something to this, and in fact he did. And in ways which don't concern us today, the pyramid was completed. Completed, some believe, as a place to bury the pharaoh and or take care of all the ceremonial that attended that. A huge temple-like structure was built in the middle of the platform. A huge temple-like structure was built there with slabs of granite as wide as this room. Long slabs of granite that could never have been manhandled up to the height that the temple reaches. It was going to be, they said, a place where Cheops, he said he would be buried, and therefore it had to be strong because periodically grave robbers would take everything out of a tomb and desecrate it. In fact, he never was buried there. He was never put there, which throws doubt on the whole matter of the pyramid being a place for such an event. When it was finished, there was a capstone put on the top. And although the Greek writers talk about the pyramid, they don't say what happened to the capstone. In fact, the Manichaeus told me that the capstone, one solid piece of material, was shaken off in an earthquake. And there are signs of earthquakes in the pyramid. These immense slabs that I was talking about are cracked in the middle, maybe from the mass of material above them, but certainly there are signs all around Egypt of earthquakes. And the capstone slithered down, and we know no more about it. So that is a second factor with the pyramid. We also know from clairvoyant perception, ours, that there are other compartments in the base of the pyramid, in the base of the truncated part of it. And Edgar Cayce said that these would be discovered eventually. He was aware of them. And I confirm that. They are there. But I'm saying that they will be discovered by advances in technology. Advances in technology will be able to show everything to do with the pyramid at whatever depth you like. Just by twisting a few knobs, you'll be able to get some sort of gram picture of every part of the pyramid. And when these rooms are eventually discovered, it is the hope of people like myself and you that they will contain Atlantean regalia, Atlantean artifacts, and the whole attitude towards Atlantis will be greatly changed. So the pyramid has gone through various periods. What I have not talked about today is the grand gallery that sticks up, pointed towards the temple, never finished, and with strange structures in it. You have a gallery four times as long as this room, as high as this room, and at least 7 feet wide. And it's at an angle which continues another tunnel, small one, and then it becomes the Grand Gallery. And there's the Grand Gallery, and the Egyptologists think, well, this was the great gallery that the pharaoh's sarcophagus would pass up, and so on. What they don't explain is some of the structures in the gallery. On the floor of the gallery, there is a central pathway, and on each side of the pathway, there are great niches built into the floor of the gallery on these two slabs. And they have been put there for some purpose. I mean, you wouldn't build a St. Paul's without putting the dome on it. And there is this immense gallery with these clear-cut holes. They're about that big, slots in the floor, obviously to winch something. Now the question is, was this something which took a large tube-like structure to act as a telescope to examine not the northern skies, but the southern skies? I don't know whether you've ever noted how clear an object becomes when you look at it like that. You know, you haven't got your glasses and you say, oh, well, you look at it like that. Oh, yes, you can pick up the word straight away. Somehow or the other, I've never heard an explanation for it. Somehow or the other, when you do that and you narrow it, and for instance, I could never see what I'm looking at now. I'm looking at the ear chart on the wall at the back. And it's quite clear to me. I can't read it, but I can't see it now. And so it's possible. I remember when I was a little boy at school. One day there was a crowd of kids in the playground looking up at the sky, and I looked up, I couldn't see anything. And then I went up and got into the crowd, and they were looking at Venus in daylight. And eventually I saw it, and there it was, very like the moon, but tiny, in the sky. And I'm pretty sure that these people, when they were plotting out the heavens on the truncated platform of the pyramid, the truncated pyramid, that they had some device which they could move for focus in this grand gallery so that it would help them to plot the heavens. If you, of course, point north, you have the North Star, the Pole Star, and during one night, all the stars here rotate around it. So you have that enormous vision of the north, and the stars present themselves. And similarly here you would have the south. I wouldn't know what the star is, but there would be a rotation. And all the stars, well, most of the stars would be seen. The ones overhead are easy. They're not aberrated. The light on the level of the planet makes it difficult to see things accurately on the horizon or above the horizon. Well, those are speculations. Sometime we will talk about inundation of the planet, the way in which the planet is going to deal with the question of salt. There'd be no Palestinian question if salt could be combated. None at all. If we could find a way of desalinating the sea and taking fresh water out of it and using that and doing it cheaply, economically, many of the problems of Egypt, the Sahara, the Middle East, the Gobi Desert, and other places, the Karoo in South Africa, the outback in Australia, and so on, would be overcome. Well, that took me a little longer to answer than I thought, and I'm going to ask you for a break now. Thank you. A question just put to me is, why do not people know intuitively? Why do people have to prove everything? All right. The problem with being intuitive is that it's an attribute of a root race yet to come. Mankind has the potential to be intuitive. He is now actively intelligent because that is the throat center of our own root race. We are devoted to the proposition of being actively intelligent. Isn't that the quality of our race? I mean, as compared to the East. But there is a race coming, and we're going to talk about it in a moment, and I'm not talking in terms of racially elite or anything. There is a race coming that will develop the intuition. But people can be intuitive today. They have the potential for it. They have some of the equipment for it, but they can't usually pull it off to order. Most people have a flash of intuition at least once in their lives, perhaps two, three, or four times. What you can't do is to control it. And the reason why you can't control intuition is that it isn't an unveiling. Intuition is a flash of energy that is discharged from the buddhic plane. And if you are, in the first place, practicing truth or beauty or goodness, and it rings true with the qualities of the buddhic plane, which will be available to us in the sixth root race, not our fifth root race, the sixth root race. When you practice truth or beauty or goodness or some of these together, you are in resonance with the buddhic plane. And the moment that happens, there's a flash of energy comes through you, and you feel it. Most people will first register it, and I call this one of the signposts on the path of unfoldment. Most people will register it as a catch in breathing, a sudden, and you don't know why. There's no reason for it. You've caught your breath. It isn't because you had curry and rice last night and your diaphragm is a bit sensitive or reactive. And then it becomes quite frequent. And if you're engaged on an important work, which is of value to truth, beauty, and goodness, you'll get it again and again. And when it happens to you, write me a letter and thank me. Because you'll know it. And the flash of energy is not exciting. Buddhi is not exciting. I have never taken drugs apart from therapeutic ones. But I suspect it's very like arsenic. I've talked to people who have taken arsenic. And It's a clarity of breathing. It's just as if you've been stuffed with carbon dioxide and fetid air for about 3 hours, and suddenly you get a gasp of clean air or oxygen or something like that. And it's a lovely feeling. And that is an indication that a release of energy from the bunic level confirms your intuitive discovery or experience. Now that can be very, very useful if you're doing research work and you find that you're struggling with a problem and you're learning to use the Claregate method, which is to propose things to the higher self who lives in the buddhic plane. If you propose, and therefore you have narrowed down what you're asking to a small range of matters, you can do an awful lot of successful research work. The nearest equivalent that I have noticed for that, have seen, was the Delaware radionic stick pad. Mrs. Delaware was an absolutely extraordinary woman. Defective in many things, yes. She hadn't had a medical education and one or two other things, but I don't bite people's heads off for that. She was brilliant in being able to line up a condition with a radionic rate. When I come to this science next time we meet, I'll show you pictures and talk about it. She could do that, and or she could have a list of conditions, and she'd have a rubber pad in front of her like that with a diaphragm, and she would touch this pad and she would go through them. Is this diabetes? Is this arthritis? Is this eczema? And instead of her fingers running over the rubber pad, they stuck. And that indicated that that condition, with its treatment, radionic treatment, was the one that needed to be applied. And it's that sort of thing. And I know that many people don't get that, well, Joe Hayes would call it a buzz, but they don't get that sort of catch in the breath, which is really the vagus nerve being stimulated. They don't get that, but they can get it on a stick pad. I have seen at the Delaware laboratories Mrs. Delaware going through a list of these things, and then she's been testing some things for arthritis, and an arthritic has walked up behind her, and suddenly there's been a loud crack, and she, "You got arthritis, my dear? Will you please go away?" She had got a massive stick when, because somebody was nearby giving off the, well, that's what it is. And so I say that intuitiveness is a latent power. It is an energy structure. And I would also say that intuitiveness must have the truth to get its reward, and it must be presented by a person who is, all right, we're all suspicious of the word immaculate, but this person must be immaculate in attitude, in character, and so on. And when a person has these things put together, and they have the right place and so on, if it's not through a stick pad, then you get that gush of energy. And that's what intuitiveness is. Then the question goes on to say, why do people have to prove everything? That's easy to answer. Things have to be proved because this damn world judges only by results. That's why things have to be proved. We say to hell with it. We're not going to try and prove these things, convert what we know to be true into your scientific language and have it wait 30 years while 700 different experimental bodies test it out and confirm it. No. We can't wait for that. Truth is truth. You don't have to prove it. I've told you a way in which you can be absolutely sure. Don't worry about what others say. Be absolutely sure that when you get that flash of energy, and I shouldn't have told you today because you really aren't ready for it, but I also told you last time that if you learn to put questions properly, you get very useful answers, and they are graded so that nobody can get hurt. Yes, the world demands that everything has to be proved, but you know, education has had to do a somersault. I taught in the East End for 10 years. I had to do that to earn the karma to do the kind of work I'm doing now. And education has changed. It's not nice for a person like me or you who are teachers here to educate a person along a specific set of disciplines and get him to pass his A levels and so on and so on. And there's no job. Or he doesn't do the thing that he was trained to do. And we still go on and on and on, dishing up the same educational process when there are beautiful things that the planet will grasp a few hundred years from now. The searching of the planet for relics of the past. Nah, you won't make a lot of money at it. But how beautiful. One of my jobs is to help restore the beauty of astrology in a very specific way. And so I wouldn't worry about proving things. If it's business you're talking about, yeah, you better get onto it and prove it and wrap it up and stick things all over it so that it'll sell well. Yeah. But we're not talking about business here. We're talking about life and how it expresses itself. So take no heed for having to prove things. If you can bring your child up so that the child is more aware than others have the opportunity to get, so that he will look inquisitively at things that are eternal, not things that will be brushed away tomorrow. There's not a thing on this planet you can take away with you that is material. Nothing. Not a single damn thing. You can struggle, you can leave it to your son, you can leave it to your grandchild, you can do what you like. You can't take it with you. But there are eternal things you can take. You can deposit in a cosmic bank through things that are simple, goodwill. We're struggling to convert this planet to one of the qualities of Venus, a planet of goodwill. You can join in group meditation at the time of the full moon. You can join the triangles movement and choose two buddies somewhere on the earth. The further flung they are, the better. And agree to join up with them in meditation once every day, and particularly at the... I can go on all afternoon telling you what you can do and what will, not selfishly, give you rewards in the cosmic bank. I'm not selling indulgences here today. That's all gone, thank heaven. And so, let us remember then that children who are brought up with this open-mindedness, placing value on things that are eternal, take them out and let them sleep out in the garden or wherever you are, and look at the heavens when they're clear at night, the stars. Let them pick up the music of the spheres things that are eternal. And in that way you will be fulfilling your duty to your child, so that he is brought up in a different way. As I say, the future will redeem all this for us. You will see marvelous youngsters coming into incarnation, and they will have opportunities to do almost anything that they want, providing it is for the disciplining of their emotions. I'm coming to that in a moment. What about this race that is coming? And I've been talking about it. Perhaps we better see what is involved. I'm going to need the rounds and chains picture. All right, let's point us out first. Here we are, the fifth root race. Teutonic in origin, Aryan, not in the Nazi sense at all. We don't have to apologize for that. A race that is going to open the throat center of humanity. And an opportunity will be provided in this race for all other races to open up the throat center. And they will suffer. Many women today who suffer from cancer of the thyroid are individuals who've had difficulty in previous lives dealing with active intelligence. They would go over the top one day, and the next day they would sit in front of the fire and a blanket round them and not see anybody. Imbalances of the throat chakra. And men who can't get the energy of the sacral center up to the throat chakra so that it can change. And so this is the fifth root race. These are roots, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And they are favored by the seven rays. And the fifth root is favored by the ray of concrete knowledge. And its color is orange, all right. Of the seven divisions here, which are all sub-races, these are sub-races of the fifth root race, seven of them. Seven sub-races of the fifth root race. Ours, now, that we're in, all right, the drawing is slightly cockeyed. Today we are here. Oh no, I see what he's done, yes. We are in the fifth sub-race of the fifth root race, and it is therefore the most powerful of the sub-races. And we call this sub-race the Anglo-Saxon sub-race of the fifth root race. And its general unfoldment is to express active intelligence. Where did it come from? The fifth sub-race came from the fifth root race came from the fifth sub-race of the last one, and that's the law. The fifth root race came from the fifth sub-race of the previous one, previous root race. So there it is. That's the race this came from, and they were the Teutonic. The Teutonic sub-race of the fourth root race. That was known roughly as the Atlantean root race. Atlanteans, their work was to open the solar plexus chakra, the chakra of feeling, of affect, of emotion. And they were to express, and they were the ones that made theater possible today. And all the things like that we are indulging in emotionally came from Atlantis. And so that was the function of the Atlantean root race, was to open the solar plexus chakra. Where did they come from? They came from the fourth sub-race of the third root race, which was the Lemurian root race. Mainly Negroid in derivation. Magnificent physical bodies. Magnificent. They fall asleep when you take them onto the mental plane there. Can't deal with, I know from South Africa, give them a bit of mental pressure they go to pieces, and they're not ready for it. So the third root race was the race that opened the sacral center, the sexual center. And this burst of energy enabled the sexes to separate into their two proper places. Before that, they were hermaphrodite. Before that, there was budding, and so on. So this is the law that each root race derives from a previous root race through the appropriate subrace. The third root race derived from the third subrace of the second. I can't go any plainer than that, nor would you if you came to my college. If you could explain that, that would be enough. You wouldn't have to go any further than that. Now, we're talking about our, we know this is our subrace. We know it quite well. It's Anglo-Saxon, it's basically German, English, and for various reasons, parts of our race have gone to Australia and to New Zealand and to America and to India and so on. And so, for reasons that we well know historically, the subrace has already expanded into different parts of the world. But the most characteristic common factor in that dissemination, that spreading, has been the exposure to sunlight. Well, you know you can't get sunburnt in England. That's our weather. And so, although this is very good for our subrace, the Anglo-Saxon, the next subrace to come, here it is, the next one, the sixth, here, the sixth subrace, is even now beginning to shape and form itself in the Anglo-Saxon subrace amongst us. And I can look around through the people I know, and I can pick out very easily bits and pieces of what are going to form the sixth subrace. And that's what I'm going to be telling you about. And our grandchildren will be well into that, or great-grandchildren will be well into that, bringing more and more parts of it together. And the most essential thing about it at this stage of our knowledge is that this subrace must be able to take more sunlight, exposure to sunlight. Therefore, they have to have a stronger etheric body. Therefore, they have to have more patent nadis. Either Sushumna and Pingala tubes must be open, widened. Now you see why I went on about electricity. So we're talking about the sixth subrace. We call it the Australo-American race, for better word, want of a better word. By that we mean that its main components are in Australia, exposed to more sunlight than they can yet stand. The sunlight out there is giving them cancer of the skin. They drink like hell because of the conditions. It's very easy to sit in England in a mild country and criticize the colonies for drinking too much. So the other part of the subrace is in California. And what is the factor there? Sunlight. Sunlight. And they love it there. They love it. They shrink up like little old lizards. But they go on and on and on and they sop it up. So here is your subrace being born. Slowly but surely, you'll see, I know certain prominent people who are manifesting. I say prominent, not because they're all prominent, but because these are people you know. If I was to tell you who had sixth subrace factors in them in the tennis world, you'll all be happy because you know the tennis characters. They're going to have a very high forehead. The space above the ear to the top of the head, especially in the front, is going to be greatly extended. The only person that I can think of that you know is it President Assad of Syria? Is that his name?
Yeah.
I had to write it down last night. Yes, President Assad. The next time you see him, have a look at that. It's an extraordinary head. Extraordinary. I almost jump out of my seat every time I see him, not because of the news, but because of the... I want a picture. The only other man that I know had that shape of head, still alive, was the man that worked the radionic camera at the Delaware Laboratories. And his name is Corti. And Corti would produce pictures from this radionic camera that are staggering. I'll be showing them to you. Staggering. But when anybody else came along, not absolutely true, but hardly anything was produced by anybody who tried to do it themselves on the camera. And for that reason, the work didn't get the recognition that it should have, because science could not understand that a camera might be so finely tuned that it would only react to a certain type of person. That's what you've got to put up with in the scientific world. That sort of nonsense. Unless it can fit into orthodox medicine's attitude, it's not valid. And that's why they're going to get a hiding.